From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I think what the summit today shows is the tremendous hunger in the region for an Israeli-Palestinian peace. The Palestinians have had a democratic election. They've elected a new leadership committed to peace through negotiations. President Bush keeps reiterating his commitment to the roadmap and to the creation of a Palestinian state. The odd man out right now is Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and it remains to be seen whether he is going to stick his heels in and be the one to block serious progress towards resolving the conflict.
There's a lot of euphoria about the summit, but on the ground, Israeli bulldozers and tanks continue to seize land, build settlements, and destroy the chances of peace. The so-called truce is likely to be nothing more than a brief intermission.
Israeli and Palestinian leaders are expected to announce a ceasefire at a summit today to end more than 4 years of bloody violence. Today, a discussion. Then President Bush has submitted his $2.5 trillion budget.
At its core, a president's budget is about priorities for the nation. And the one thing that's clear from this budget is the priority of this administration is tax cuts for Americans who are the best off and have benefited the most from previous tax cuts, and in contrast to cuts for programs that serve middle and income Americans.
Then finally, the classic civil rights series, Eyes on the Prize, cannot be broadcast or sold in the United States. Today, there will be 50 guerrilla screenings across the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the first Israeli-Palestinian summit in 4 years, Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas are meeting today in Egypt to verbally agree to end 4 years of fighting. Since the Intifada began in September 2000, about 3,600 Palestinians and 1,050 Israelis have been killed in fighting. Abbas is expected to announce the end of the Intifada, and Sharon will vow to refrain from any military action in the occupied territories if the ceasefire is not broken. The meeting marks the first time Sharon and Abbas have met since the death of Yasser Arafat. On Monday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice announced President Bush will meet separately in the spring with each leader. In addition, Bush plans appointing a senior security coordinator to help train and equip Palestinian forces and monitor Israeli and Palestinian promises. Rice met with Abbas in Ramallah on Monday, but decided not to visit Arafat's nearby tomb. In other news from the region, Palestinian residents in the West Bank town of Qalqilya have blamed the Israeli separation wall for widespread flooding, because the wall has trapped water inside the town. The wall almost completely encloses the farming community. For months, residents complained the wall cut off the town from surrounding farmland, as well as jobs, schools, and medical care. In Iraq, the country's interim interior minister said Monday it could take 18 more months before Iraqi security forces would be prepared to properly secure the country. His comments came as a pair of suicide bombings killed more than 25 people in two of the deadliest attacks since last week's election. Earlier today, another 21 Iraqis died after a bomb went off near an Iraqi army recruitment center in West Baghdad. In other Iraq news, hundreds of Iraqis from Mosul demonstrated Sunday outside the heavily guarded Green Zone to protest the disenfranchisement of thousands of voters in Mosul. The demonstrators included many Iraqi Christians who said polling centers never opened in their neighborhoods. The groups estimated as many as 200,000 people around Mosul were prevented from voting. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee has approved Michael Chertoff as Homeland Security Director by a voice vote. Senator Carl Levin voted present to protest what he said was the unwillingness of the Justice Department to provide information about accusations of unusually harsh interrogations at Guantanamo. In other news on Guantanamo Bay, an attorney for 11 Kuwaiti prisoners held at the U.S. prison claimed their clients have been beaten with chains, sodomized, and given electrical shocks. The attorney learned of the abuse after a meeting with the Kuwaitis. Meanwhile, a former Australian detainee at Guantanamo has accused U.S. officials of secretly listening to conversations he had with his attorney. Mamdou Habib said officials then used information they obtained from the eavesdropping during interrogations to get at him psychologically. Habib's attorney, Stephen Hopper, said, quote, "The American authorities were obviously listening in to private conferences and not respecting client-lawyer privilege as they said they would do." The United Nations is calling on world governments to fulfill their pledges to help the victims of December's tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Governments pledge nearly $1 billion, but only about $360 million have been received so far. An Oxfam spokesperson criticized the inaction, saying, quote, "When the public pledged their funds, these were delivered in hours, yet governments have had over a month and far less than 50% has been delivered." The Republican National Committee has sent letters to TV stations across the country asking them not to air a new commercial that criticizes President Bush's proposal to privatize Social Security. The ad, which was produced by the group MoveOn.org, claims privatization will result in Social Security benefit cuts of up to 46%. In the letter, RNC Deputy Counsel Michael Bayes writes, "As an FCC licensee, the stations must, quote, protect the integrity of the American marketplace of ideas and to avoid broadcasting deliberate misrepresentations of the facts." The letter goes on to read, quote, "This letter places you on notice that the information contained in the above-cited advertisement is false and misleading. This is the ad the RNC doesn't want you to see."
First, someone thought up the working lunch. Then we discovered the working vacation. And now, thanks to George Bush's planned Social Security benefit cuts of up to 46% to pay for private accounts, it won't be long before America introduces the world to the working retirement. Call your representatives today and tell them no, George Bush can't cut Social Security.
MoveOn has defended the ad, saying the information in the ad is based on an analysis performed by the chief actuary at the Social Security Administration. In Nepal, military troops have attacked Maoist rebel camps in the jungles in a new offensive that began after the Nepali king seized power last week. Reuters reports dozens of rebels may have been killed. Last week, the Nepali king, Gyanendra, sacked the entire government and suspended all civil rights, including the right of the press to criticize the government. Since then, hundreds of political leaders, activists, journalists, and human rights workers have been arrested around Nepal. In Boston, former priest Paul Shanley has been convicted of raping and assaulting a young boy in the 80s. He faces up to life in prison. The victim, who's now 27-year-old firefighter, said the priest began raping him when he was 6 years old, when he was attending religious school at Shanley's church. The National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee is encouraging taxpayers opposed to the war in Iraq to file a peace tax return when they file taxes with the IRS. The group has published two types of peace tax returns, one for tax resistors who are refusing to pay for part or all of their federal taxes, and another for taxpayers who want to request the federal government divert their taxes to non-military programs. The letter reads in part, quote, "Each year, at least half of our tax dollars are used to pay for current and past wars. If instead this money were invested in peace initiatives and aid programs, we could truly build a better and more secure world."
Hell, we're paying taxes for. Well, now what do we all stop paying taxes?
Sharon Jones, what if we all stop paying taxes? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli and Palestinian leaders are expected to announce a ceasefire deal today to end more than 4 years of bloodshed, which has claimed over 4,000 lives. Some 3,300 Palestinians and 970 Israelis have been killed since the beginning of the Intifada. The Israeli Prime Minister, General Ariel Sharon, and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas are expected to declare a truce at a summit in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh today. The meeting's the highest-level talks between the two sides since 2000. Abbas is expected to announce the end of the Intifada, and Sharon will vow to refrain from any military action in the occupied territories if the ceasefire is not broken. The talks are also being attended by Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordan's King Abdullah. Sharon's spokesperson, Renan Gissin, said each side would make a separate declaration of an end to violence rather than signing a ceasefire agreement. The chief Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, told Reuters he anticipates the establishment of joint committees to oversee the release of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails and the phased withdrawal of Israeli forces from Palestinian areas of the West Bank. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with Abbas yesterday in Ramallah. She's appointed an army general as, quote, security coordinator to supervise reform of Palestinian security forces. The general, William Ward, is former commander of the NATO Stabilization Force in Bosnia-Herzegovina and has served in Egypt as military liaison officer. Both Abbas and Sharon have accepted invitations to make separate visits to Washington in the spring. To talk about the ceasefire deal, we're joined by two guests. Hussein Ibish joins us in our D.C. studio. He's a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. And on the phone with us from Chicago, we're joined by Ali Abu Nima, the founder of Electronic Intifada. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Hussein Ibish, let's begin with you. Talk about the latest developments today and the ceasefire?
Well, I think it's extremely interesting. First of all, what you're looking at, actually, is a series of events that are putting Prime Minister Sharon increasingly out of step with the other actors, and I think putting him in a diplomatic box in a very interesting way. You must remember that it was Sharon who led Israel away from the talks, in the sense that the talks continued throughout 2000, up until January 2001 at Taba, where all sides said significant progress was being made. They were cut short by Ehud Barak in preparation for the Israeli elections. Sharon won the election in February 2001, and since then there has been no negotiation and no interest, I believe, on the part of Ariel Sharon in resuming negotiations. I think what has happened is, with the Palestinian election, the victory of Mahmoud Abbas, and the re-election of President Bush and his very public recommitment to the roadmap and to his a so-called vision of two states living side by side, you've ended up with a situation where Sharon's stated intention, as expressed by his senior advisor, Dolph Weissglass, to put the all movement in formaldehyde and to prevent anything that might inch towards the creation of a Palestinian state on hold permanently, is being severely disrupted. As for the ceasefire itself, I think it's going to be a very important part of what I see as a Palestinian diplomatic offensive here to box in Ariel Sharon. And I think it's likely to strengthen their position rather than his, although, of course, there's every reason to be skeptical. I mean, if you look at the history of the conflict, anyone who's Pollyanna-ish or thinks this is going to be a panacea or thinks everything is going to clear up overnight is kidding themselves. But as I say, I think it's interesting to watch the sort of noose tighten around Mr. Sharon and his refusal to cooperate.
Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada, your response?
Well, it's good to try to put an optimistic and positive spin on things, but I really can't share the optimism. I think what we're seeing is absolutely nothing new. We have seen the total replacement of substance with form, and I don't see that Ariel Sharon is coming under increasing pressure from any of the other actors. On the contrary, Yesterday, the Washington Post published a detailed investigation showing the extent to which Israel is accelerating the construction of Jewish-only colonies in the occupied West Bank, an effort calculated and intended to prevent the emergence of any Palestinian state. And we see absolutely no pressure from the international community. Times were when U.S. secretaries of state would go to the region and they would explicitly talk about the settlements. Condoleezza Rice just came back. She didn't even mention the word settlement. She made a vague statement about Israel having to take hard decisions. As for a ceasefire, I would very much like to see a full ceasefire. The problem here is if you look at the statements, and Sharon is speaking right now, but what has been leaked from the Israeli side, is there's nothing new in the Israeli formulation. They reserve the right to act in what they call self-defense. But Israel has never admitted to anything other than self-defense. So really, I think there's nothing new here. And what has been demanded is that Israel be allowed to continue seizing Palestinian land, building settlements, while the Palestinians have the responsibility for policing themselves and ensuring that nothing disturbs Israel's colonization. I want to see a genuine truce. I would like to see an end to all violence. The problem is that the definition of violence has been tailored to exclude the most significant source of the violence, which is Israel's continued violent colonization of occupied Palestinian land. Just last week, the Israelis announced their plan to destroy the entire Al-Muntar neighborhood in occupied East Jerusalem. Previously, they announced their plan to demolish up to 3,000 more homes of Palestinian refugees in Rafah as part of their so-called Gaza disengagement. So I'm very, very doubtful that we're going to see any change on the ground. And optimism is fine, but I think it's going to be overtaken by events fairly rapidly, because absolutely nothing has changed in the fundamental relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and nothing has changed in terms of the U.S. approach to the region. Last spring, the United States formally endorsed Ariel Sharon's position that the bulk of the settlements in the occupied territories will remain in Israeli hands forever. And there's absolutely no reason to believe this is anything more than a truce of convenience for Sharon and Abbas, who both have domestic reasons why they want to make the appearance of progress. But even on the issue of prisoners, the Israelis have given absolutely nothing to the Palestinians. So optimism is good, but it needs to be based on some kind of evidence.
Hussein Ibish.
Well, I think that, you know, obviously, this is, if it's to turn into anything, this is only the first halting start. And as I say, you know, if you point to the history of the conflict, there is no particular reason to be Pollyannish or optimistic. At the same time, I think it's pretty clear that this is not a situation that Sharon wanted to be in. I think that it's pretty clear that he didn't have an interest in interacting with a Palestinian interlocutor, that what suited him was to dictate unilateral measures such as the unilateral Gaza disengagement plan, and not to have any conversations, let alone negotiations. I think this has been his general approach. And I think that is coming under pressure, and I think that this summit is an example of that. I just don't think this suits his style and his strategy at all. So, we have to agree to disagree on that. Whether it actually proves to be something that grows into a more significant process, obviously, is something that remains to be seen. But as I say, I think generally speaking, this is more in sync with the Palestinian strategy. Let me say this. The Intifada has gone on for 4 years, almost entirely without any kind of strategic direction. Now, one might question whether this is a proper strategic direction or not, but let's just say we're starting to see more signs of a strategic direction that involves the addition of diplomacy as well as other means available to the Palestinians. Certainly, Even if one were to agree to a truce, one is not renouncing the right of self-defense. I don't think that's ever been done, and I don't think that's ever going to be done. As for international pressure on the Israelis, I mean, I fully agree that the deck is stacked against Palestinians. That's why we're all part of this effort to support Palestinian human and national rights. But I think it is important to note that the plan the Israelis had to apply the absentee property law to East Jerusalem and to steal thousands and thousands of acres and homes and buildings from Palestinians was blocked and was blocked through international pressure recently. And so while obviously Ariel Sharon is being allowed to get away with a great deal of stuff that he shouldn't be, at the same time, I don't think it's true that there's absolutely no pressure whatsoever. I don't think it's true that the international world plays absolutely no role. You know, my feeling is that it's the easiest thing in the world to be pessimistic and to say that nothing has changed. And I think, you know, as I say, that history gives one a solid ground to do that. But I think one has to move forward, and one has to be careful not to be addled by cynicism and not to become sort of trapped in a discourse that sees no possibilities. I would not certainly say that anything fundamental has changed or that this is the dawn of a new era or anything like that. But I would say that this is a situation overall, in terms of this summit and in terms of where the diplomacy is going, that is better for a Palestinian strategy than for Ariel Sharon's version of Israel's strategy.
Mm-hmm. And Condoleezza Rice, Ali Abu Nima, your thoughts. Does she represent any kind of departure from Colin Powell on this, her first overseas trip?
No, I don't think the personalities make a difference at all. I think that, you know, U.S. policy is set by a number of competing forces and interests that tend to move very slowly, and nothing fundamental has changed. I mean, Colin Powell, when he first started his tenure, went to the region and made statements far more bold than anything Condoleezza Rice has ever said. And I agree with her saying it's important not to be cynical and not to be stuck in an analysis that doesn't get you anywhere. But I do think we have to be realistic. And, you know, what we've seen in this summit is the victory of the Israeli conception that the Palestinians are the aggressors and Israel is merely defending itself, while completely unaddressed is the deepening occupation, the growing colonies. Nobody is talking about that. And this summit is dealing only with symptoms. The intifada and the violence are not the cause of the conflict. As Hussein has said many times, the occupation is what fuels the conflict. The settlements, the devastation of Palestinian land and homes, that's continuing. Israel hasn't pledged to stop that. Israel, as far as the application of the absentee property law in occupied Jerusalem, it's very good that the Israelis said that they won't do that. But what we've seen in the past by Israel is tactical retreats, followed by them going ahead and doing things anyway. The landscape of the occupied territories are riddled with settlements built on places the Israelis pledged not to touch. And I think we have to see substantial, you know, if this start, let's be optimistic, is to lead to something, we have to see massive and immediate international pressure on Israel to end the settlement expansion, yeah, to end the demolition of homes, right, and to end the measures which are continuing absolutely unabated.
Right.
What I expect will happen, though, is that there will be all this focus on what Palestinians have to do, and Israel will continue to do what it's doing, and when Palestinians react to that, we'll be told it's the Palestinians who are disturbing the peace process. Final point is that, you know, Sharon may not have wanted to be in Sharm el-Sheikh, but the Israelis are tacticians and they know how to read the wind. So if it suits them to go to Sharm el-Sheikh and put on a good show, they will. We remember the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who went to the Madrid conference in 1991 and said afterwards very clearly in his memoirs that, you know, I was under pressure to go. I went with the intention of dragging the negotiations on forever. And while we build the settlements, and Israel is doing exactly the same thing now. And, you know, the onus is on Israel and on those who are reading some sort of change in the situation to really show that that's happening. In the meantime, I'm going to remain focused like a laser beam on the continued destruction of Palestinian society by the occupation and the settlers.
Well,
I agree with you that we're only dealing with symptoms. The thing is, the roadmap provides a template for pressuring Israel to do exactly what you were saying, end its settlement activities. And I think that has to be the focus, to come back time and again to the roadmap.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us and ask you, Hussein Ibish, is American Task Force on Palestine a new organization?
It's been around for a couple of years, and it is an independent American organization dedicated to seeking peace through the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you as well,
pleasure,
of course,
Amy.
To Ali Abu
Nima. And thanks to Ali, yeah.
Of Electronic Intifada. And this is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the budget that the president has handed to Congress. Stay with us. Marcel Khalife here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush sent Congress a federal budget yesterday that some say reads like a hit list against almost every social program paid for by U.S. taxpayers. It calls for the elimination of some 150 government programs. One out of every three of the targeted programs concerns education. Bush's plan would slash aid to cities by one-third, eliminate health insurance for thousands of low-income families, reduce veterans' medical benefits, cut funding for city cops and county sheriffs, wipe out child care subsidies for some 300,000 families, trim funding for clean water and soil conservation, and shutter dozens of programs for preschool children and at-risk youth. The budget also targets public housing, Medicaid, and farmers. In addition, Bush is proposing to cut the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency by $450 million, to cut $100 million from a Bureau of Indian Affairs program that helps build schools, and to cut $200 million for home heating aid for the poor. But President Bush isn't cutting back on all federal programs. The budget calls for a $19 billion increase in Pentagon spending. At a news conference in Washington, Bush spoke to reporters about his budget plan.
I look forward to explaining to the American people why we made some of the requests that we made in our budget. I fully understand that sometimes it's hard to eliminate a program that sounds good. But by getting people to focus on results, I'm saying to the members of Congress, show us the results as to whether or not this program is working.
President Bush speaking about his budget yesterday. Well, we're joined by Jim Horney, senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, first of all, your overall response to the president's budget.
I think what's interesting about the budget is that the spending cuts that you were just talking about, which are quite severe cuts, we're talking about cuts totaling $212 billion over the next 5 years for domestic discretionary, that is annually appropriated spending, which is virtually frozen at the current dollar level for 5 years. And by 2010, programs would have to be reduced by 16%. That's a very deep cut. Keep in mind that these cuts are proposed by the administration in the name of deficit reduction. But one of the really interesting things is that over the next 5 years, according to the administration's own numbers, the policies proposed in the budget actually add to the deficit about $29 billion. And the reason for that, of course, is part of it is increases in defense spending and increases in homeland security. But a very large reason for that is the tax cuts that the president proposed. So the administration is saying we have big deficits, which is certainly true. We need to do something about it. But they would propose that all of the burden be put on domestic spending programs. These are programs that, in addition to providing just the day-to-day activities of the government, provide assistance to low- and middle-income Americans, people who really need the help the most. But this budget puts all of the burden for so-called deficit reduction on. As I say, it's completely offset, more than offset, by increased tax cuts and increased spending for defense and homeland security. It's also interesting that some would claim that we have to cut domestic spending because that spending has been running away, and they would have you believe that such spending is responsible for the deficits that we have. And that simply isn't true. Any way you look at it, it's not true. If you look at the dramatic turnaround from when we had a surplus in 2000 to the deficits we have today, if you look at the change in spending and revenues as a percent of GDP, it's clear that the reductions in revenues, which came from the tax cuts as well as changes in collections relative to the size of the economy, account for 71% of that change. It's absolutely clear it's not because spending has exploded that we've gone back into deficit. It's because revenues have gone down. Similarly, if you look at legislation enacted since 2001, the domestic part of the budget, which is the only thing that is being proposed for cuts in this budget, accounts for only about 1/7 of the cost of that legislation. 48% of the cost comes from tax cuts. So the administration is clearly showing that it has its priorities, what I think are backwards, in cutting programs, and programs that the programs that will be cut are ones that really do help people in America who need help the most. Cutting that while at the same time proposing big new tax cuts totaling $1.4 trillion over the next 10 years, having those big tax cuts, but saying we've got to cut spending.
We're talking to Jim Horney, who's a senior budget fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Jim, wanted to ask you about the Environmental Protection Agency, $450 million proposed cut. How significant is that?
I have to admit I have not had a chance really to look at that. Yesterday, in looking at the budget, focused on the overall numbers and some of the programs like Medicaid, child care, other food stamps that would be hurt. But from what I have seen about the proposals for the environment, particularly for EPA, it looks like that would be a very severe cutback in some of the efforts to reduce pollution in the country.
Do you think that some of these cuts aren't as much to do with saving money, but is actually shifting policy by taking away money from regulators of companies involved with pollution?
That's certainly a possibility. Again, that's not an area that I have any expertise in, but that wouldn't be surprising. I think it's also, as I say, it's clear that this is not really about reducing the deficit. It is about paying for tax cuts. And then the choices that are made about where those cuts come certainly reflect the priorities of the administration, of the programs that they care the most about and the kinds of things they want to achieve.
What about the response right now from the Republicans as well as the Democrats? How are people falling on what sides here?
I think it's clear that there will be resistance to a number of the spending cuts the president proposed. You've seen that already in answers not only from Democrats but from influential Republicans on Capitol Hill. The frightening thing, though, is that to the extent that the Congress says, well, we will accept your overall cuts, we think you should cut spending, but we don't like some of the particular ones, and ones that have gotten big reaction so far, for instance, proposed cuts in farm spending, some increased user fees for veterans' health care, variety of things. If the Congress says, we'll go along with your overall spending numbers, we'll accept the discretionary spending caps that you've proposed for the next 5 years, which assume that domestic discretionary spending is frozen at the last year's level, but they refuse to go along with some of the specific cuts the president proposed, that means cuts in other areas that don't have as strong constituencies could end up being cut by much more. So instead of, for instance, on domestic discretionary, having a 16% cut across the board, you could end up with some programs being protected, and much deeper, 20, 25, 30, even bigger cuts in other programs that don't have the big constituencies on Capitol Hill.
How does a budget get approved? Is the process the same? Is it changing now under President Bush?
The process is more or less the same. Essentially what happens is the president sends a budget up, and it's not a simple process. It's not one where a piece of budget legislation comes from the White House, laid down in Congress, and then Congress simply passes that or turns it down. The budget is actually considered in a number of different steps. The first one is the budget committees, and then House and Senate consider a budget resolution, which doesn't actually implement any of the proposals. It simply sets a blueprint or a plan for subsequent consideration of appropriation bills. In the past, it's been 13 appropriation bills. They're talking about reducing that this year. And then the legislation that has to implement tax cuts and changes in entitlement programs. So there are a number of steps. Along the way, the president's plan can be changed. And sometimes that may be for the better from our perspective, sometimes not.
This issue of funding for police and firefighters slashed. This is a law and order administration, supposedly, and also veterans support.
I think that does indicate that you have to look carefully at what is actually being done as far as the level of support that is being provided, rather than simply listen to rhetoric about what kinds of things you want to achieve. People have been concerned, for instance, about the claims from the administration about No Child Left Behind and what they're doing for education, but when people have looked at the actual funding that's been proposed, they think sometimes that comes up short of the claims.
The issue of food stamps, expected is a $1 billion cut in a $32 billion program, and the issue of Medicaid and child care. Can you talk specifically how this will affect people, how affect kids, affect women?
It's really interesting that we have these proposed cuts at a time when poverty has increased for 3 years in a row. The income distribution is getting more and more skewed away from low, moderate income people to high income. We have a record number of uninsured health people who don't have health insurance in this country. But we have proposals here to cut Medicaid by $45 billion. And states, as you know, are already scrambling to try to find funding for their share of Medicaid costs. These cuts could almost certainly lead them to take steps that would leave even more people without adequate insurance. Food stamps is a $1 billion cost cut. That translates into 200,000 to 300,000 families being terminated. The administration has proposed freezing child care funding for 5 years. According to their numbers, that means 300,000 people will be terminated. So at a time when the trends in the society and the economy are against people who are most in need, and where high-income people have seen their incomes go up and their taxes cut, here we have more cuts for programs that are helping the people who really need it.
Finally, the federal subsidies for Amtrak, they're considering cutting all of them?
That's the proposal. This administration has not favored funding for Amtrak. This is one where There are powerful supporters of Amtrak in the Congress, and not at all clear that the administration's proposal will be enacted.
Well, Jim Horney, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a senior fellow at the Center for the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Democracy Now. When we come back, we're going to find out what's going up on screens around the country today. Guerrilla screenings. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, on public access TV stations and PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and are closed captioned for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. The music was Jagged Jazzist Day. I'm Amy Goodman. In cities around the country today, people will gather for what's being called a nationwide screening. Nationwide screening of Eyes on the Prize. That's the famed documentary on the civil rights movement. The campaign is being organized by a music activist group called Downhill Battle, and it's a response to copyright laws that have kept the series off TV and out of print for a decade. The screening is called Eyes on the Screen. Eyes on the Prize is made up of news footage, photographs, songs, and lyrics from the civil rights movement that are tangled up in a web of licensing restrictions. Many of these licenses had expired by 1995, and the film's production company, Blackside, could not afford the exorbitant costs of renewing them. Eyes on the Prize has been unavailable to the public ever since. The documentary's owners are trying to get it back in circulation, but are facing some very restrictive laws. The 14-part film was last shown in 92. The film won 6 Emmys, and the segment Bridge to Freedom 1965 was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. A touching and intimate scene in the film shows staff members singing Happy Birthday to Martin Luther King on his 39th and last birthday. But copyright laws protect the song as well as much of the television footage and photos used. Last week, Lawrence Guillot, a prominent civil rights leader with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, told the Washington Post, quote, "This is analogous to stopping the circulation of all the books about Martin Luther King, stopping the circulation of all the books about Malcolm X, stopping the circulation of books about the founding of America. I would call upon everyone whose access to Eyes on the Prize to openly violate violate any and all laws regarding its showing, he said. Well, we're joined in our Washington studio by Lawrence Guillot, a veteran civil rights activist and former member of SNCC. That's the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We're also joined on the line by Rick Prelinger, a professional archivist who's been working to increase public access to online content. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Lawrence Guillot in the Reuters studio in Washington. Talk about this movement and the significance of Eyes on the Prize. I don't think most people realize you can no longer buy the series or watch it on television.
Well, I just think it is the most important documentary that stands for the simple proposition on which this country was founded, that people, this is a visual, graphic, empathic lesson that people can make policy that has national ramifications. One of the slogans of that period was, the hands that pick cotton pick presidents. Well, Jimmy Carter and Clinton were president because of the vote created by that civil rights movement. There's never been a documentary that has the impact that is as well-researched and that has I consider it a national and cultural icon. And this fight should not be limited simply in the parameters of copyright law. We want Black Side to win this fight. And what we're doing, and I believe that by showing the Eyes on the Prize and creating a greater market for it, we're encouraging people to go out and buy it, and we're also encouraging people to send letters of support to Black Side. So we want to move this to what it really is. This is about, if there was ever a time for people, for the progressives in America, to really fight for the right to reestablish our commitment to making policy by activism, now is the time. We've just lost the presidency, we've just lost the Congress and the Senate. We cannot afford not to use every weapon we have, especially one of the most important ones.
So can you talk, Lawrence Guillot, about what exactly the problem is? I mean, Blackside is such an important production company. When Eyes on the Prize came out, I mean, it's a true classic. What happened at that time?
What happened at that time, they purchased the right, they paid royalties to some of the songs and footage for a certain period of time. Then there was a time to Mr. Hampton died. Then there was a time to renew those agreements. It simply didn't happen. Now we have a need to, those royalties need to be paid, and we're not opposing any of that. My concern, so where we are right now is we want to get as many people involved in the country in preserving this by accelerating it. I think that the Ford Foundation has given Blackside money to find out what is the actual cost. So I don't want to, this is America, so eventually it gets around to the money. But I believe that there's an issue that's more important than the money, and that is, why should we delay 1 second settling this and moving it, putting it back into public access? And understand me, again, we support Blackside doing that. We're not questioning their right to do it. We want to make sure that it is actually fungible, and their ability to do it is a reality.
Rick Prelinger, you're a professional archivist with archive.org. You've been working to increase public access to online content. Can you talk about Eyes on the Prize in your domain?
Sure. Eyes on the Prize was a really, really important program. I remember when it was being made, and we helped the producers with information about civil rights material that was located in obscure collections around the country, especially in the South. And one of the issues I think that's kind of coming to a head is the control of historical and cultural material by private organizations. And, you know, this is a capitalist system, and to some extent is going to be inevitable for a while. But on the other hand, it means that if you have possession of, or if you own copyright to historical and cultural material, you can really name your price. And as a result, public access is really, really limited. And, you know, this is where I think copyright isn't just a consumer issue, but it's also, you know, a real issue of freedom of expression, freedom of inquiry, freedom of access to history. The What the downhill battle has done is kind of really kind of provoking public debate in a way that I think is important. It means, you know, copyright isn't just about kids allegedly downloading music or people selling pirated DVDs on the streets. It's really about, you know, some profound issues of our own access to our own history.
Can you talk about how copyright works online, Rick?
It's the same, you know, in the physical world and in the online world, with one major exception: that works that exist in digital form carry additional restrictions. And then today we also have this really disturbing thing that's developing, which is, you know, normally in the old days, traditionally, copyright used to have a limited term. Somebody would take out a copyright for 28 years. If they chose to renew it, it would last another 28, and then it would expire. This isn't true anymore because large corporations have gone to Washington and, you know, lobbied to enact laws where copyright lasts much, much longer, and Congress seems to have the right to extend it indefinitely. And as a result, we no longer have a public domain. We have an old public domain, but we don't have a growing public domain. So, for example, if you're a baby boomer, a lot of the culture that reflects your history is in the public domain. If you happen to be a member of so-called Gen X or a younger group, you don't have the freedom to go ahead and pull material out of your past and rework, analyze, and understand it.
Can you, Lawrence Goyot, talk about what is happening today around the country?
We're calling upon people throughout America to sponsor showings of the film, and it doesn't matter what segment. There are 14 segments. We're not saying, please show just segment one. We're asking people not to charge admission, but we're asking people to really hold a discussion about this and communicate their interest in Black Side, in this film, to Black Side. We don't see anything we want to make sure that there's as much public exposure as this, as much public involvement. And yes, we want to bring some noise to this, that this is our film. We've never had a greater need for it. I went through the civil rights movement. I know what it's like. And I know that the America we're facing today is a retrogression of where we were then. This film is necessary. I don't see why we would deprive young Americans of this, one of the most important educational pieces that flowed out of the civil rights movement. So we're asking people, and it's not too late to start planning it right now, pull together a showing. If you don't have any all of the copies, call someone that you know, use their copy. Let's get this done, and let's talk about it, and let's keep the press open to this idea. Today is the beginning. It certainly is not the end until we all have public access to Eyes on the Prize.
Can you talk, for young people especially, who don't even know what we're talking about, Eyes on the Prize, mm-hmm. You, Lawrence Goyot, are a key figure, a SNCC organizer, a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the civil rights movement. Can you talk about some of what Eyes on the Prize conveyed that we don't get in other documentaries?
Eyes on the Prize demonstrates that, specifically in the state of Mississippi, that people who were told your name and address will be posted in the newspaper when you register to vote, that you're not allowed to congregate in numbers of more than five, that every law that could possibly be designed to stop them from organizing, and yet this is the group, this is the state that pulled off the Summer Project. This is the state that pulled off the creation of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. This is the state, and all of this involved young people, people who were young enough to understand that they had the power and the ability to change the country. And quite frankly, if you look at the civil rights changes and understand the role that is documented by Eyes on the Prize, you get a different picture of this country. You get a picture that says, yes, ordinary people can do astoundingly extraordinary things. It's in Eyes on the Prize, and there's absolutely no reason that it shouldn't be out and available to the public now. I know of no better educational documentary that demonstrates that ordinary people can really do some astoundingly extraordinary things. And it makes very clearly, young people were actively involved and are part of, they were not spectators, they were activists. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, Isn't that the best way to get people interested in education, to get them involved in a national movement that has been documented, that is graphic, and it's time now to replicate that movement. And the best way to do it is to begin with what happened, and now let's make it happen again.
Lawrence Scout, if people want to do this screening, how do they get access to Eyes on the Prize? I mean, you can go to any store. You can't get it. On Amazon, you can see it on sale for something like $1,000. How would someone get access to the program, this
series? Well, there are quite a few ways you can get access. One, libraries have it, and it's accessible in libraries. Two, the individuals who were involved in the civil rights movement who have copies, and I'm sure they would share them to accelerate and expand the number of showings. And that's about it. Other people have created access in other ways. Whatever way the film is available, please let's go out and do it. Tiffany can be reached at 508-963-1096. She's coordinating these showings. Let's make this happen. Let's go out and make it a reality.
I'm looking now at downhillbattle.org that shows something like 63 screenings from Tucson, Arizona, to Davis, California, Los Angeles, UCLA, Mountain View, California, a lot in California, San Francisco and Palo Alto and other places. Rick Prelinger, can you just talk about what you are working on online, trying to increasingly make content available free to all?
Yes, I work with the Internet Archive, which is an online collection of all kinds of material that's free to download and in many cases free to work with. In fact, we host the Democracy Now! Archives, I believe, and we have our own Prelinger Archives collection, which is 2,000 archival historical films that are available for free download. And I'm not just saying to look at or to stream. I'm saying to actually download, to re-edit, to make part of your own material. There's some very interesting material, by the way, about the civil rights movement in the United States and about the struggles of African Americans and working people that is available for free, unrestricted use. And what we're trying to do is open up public access to the public domain and make sure that there's a strong, robust public domain for essentially, so, you know, these days people don't just, you know, look at film or TV and they don't just listen to music. They make their own. Today's reader is a writer and today's viewer is also a filmmaker. And, you know, we look at authorship and access in really, really broad terms, and we want to make it possible for people to do their own. So people might want to check out archive.org and see what kind of resources are available. I think they'll really be pleasantly surprised.
Rick Prelinger, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And if people want to go online, where do they go?
To www.archive.org.
And Lawrence Guillot, where should people go online to get more information?
www.eyesonthescreen.org. And if anyone out there owns copies of Eyes on the Prize, let Tiffany know so that can facilitate. And we need to move these showing from 63 to 600.
On that note, get contact information on our website at democracynow.org. I want to thank you both for being with us as we wrap up. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'll see people in Phoenix, Arizona on Friday night, on Saturday in Olympia, Washington. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.